On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The father of modern economics, Adam Smith, wrote more than 200 years ago about the all-powerful invisible hand of the market. It was tough, he said, but good for all. The late Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman was the great champion of the invisible hand in free markets. Governments, he said, should just let markets do their work. Our guest this hour, economist Duncan Foley, says, wait a minute, this is free market theology, he says, and it's producing a value-free society, an unequal society, an immoral society. Up next on Point, the author of Adam's Fallacy meets the defenders of Adam Smith. We'll hear in this hour from free market defender Alan Meltzer and dip into a 2005 conversation I had with market champion Milton Friedman. But joining me first from New York is Duncan Foley. He's professor of economics at the New School for Social Research, and he's author of a new book that's turning lots of heads. It's called Adam's Fallacy, A Guide to Economic Theology. Duncan Foley, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Take us into the heart of the fallacy that you're describing here and pinning on Adam Smith. What is it? How do you define it?
Well, you did a pretty good job of explaining the basic premise of the book. It is that while Adam Smith has a lot of important things to say about capitalist market economies, and certainly there are a lot of good things that capitalist market economies and the energies they unleash can do for us, he does make this rather strange argument that the usual problem of moral decision-making in human life, that we have to balance self-interest against regard for others, is somehow suspended in the context of competitive market interactions. And I think that is a fallacy. I'm interested in it not just for that, but also because it starts a whole line of thinking that says the economy is a sphere different from the rest of human life and subject to its own laws. And that's really the story that the book tries to tell in detail.
I mean, you write really along a big economic history here, but you wrap it, you don't describe it as a history, you describe it as a study of economic theology. What do you mean by that? Are you disparaging this? Are you saying this is voodoo, just a dark belief, that it's not scientific? What do you mean to say by calling it theology?
I think I don't want to disparage it. I admire the writers that I write about a lot, and I think you learn a great deal from them. I think, though, it's a bit of a fantasy or a conceit to think that you can talk about something as complex and human as the economy without values being deeply intermixed in it. And I think that's where Adam Smith made a breakthrough, and it's why he's regarded as the father of modern political economy and economics, so that you have to approach this as both a science and a theological discussion. The two are inextricably intertwined.
We'll get into the details of it, but look at the big picture with us for a moment. If you look at it at the world, since Adam Smith's time, there's been an awful lot of market dynamic at work there. We've been taught and have pretty well been inculcated to accept that, embrace it. But if you look around, there's been an awful lot of economic growth, people living materially far better lives than they did a couple of centuries ago. So broad scale, is Adam Smith not borne out, or are you finding a fly in the soup?
There's no doubt that the development of market capitalism on an historical and world scale has greatly increased material productivity. But, you know, ultimately material productivity comes because people are working hard, they have good ideas, they invent new things. It doesn't come because they are following a particular value system or that they are correctly using the market. The market can facilitate that. It's one of many ways to facilitate that, but it's not the only way. It's also true that this great growth in material wealth that we see in some parts of the world is very unevenly distributed, and a lot of the world is not participating in it. And if you look at the way that worked in all of the societies where it took place, you can see that it always has huge unevenness.
You say that the market's not the only way, and yet many people drew the opposite conclusion from essentially the economic failures of a lot of communist and socialist countries, where the intent was good, where people may even have worked hard, but cumulatively it didn't mount up to the kind of economic growth and prosperity that we have. Isn't that a kind of refutation? Didn't that suggest to an awful lot of people that the market is the way?
The Soviet experiment clearly went on way too long and degenerated from its early successes in providing some material growth. In the book, I tend to argue that the role of Marxism in the 20th century in socialist countries was more to be a transition to capitalism or to capitalist values or what people often call modernism. And you see that most clearly, I think, in the case of a country like China, where a Marxist-communist regime is now trying to sponsor what looks very much like capital accumulation.
So you look at it as a way station on the way to capitalism. When you see those markets at work, then how do you see ultimately the downside? They're creating more material wealth. You acknowledge that over an extended period. It's not perfect, but is it the best we can do?
Look, I'm not against the market. That's another thing I'd like to be clear on. I think the markets can be very creative, very good ways to deal with things. I think we tend to neglect the fact that markets only exist in a context that's created by other institutions, by laws, by courts, by government intervention, by government institutions. And the record is that you got to have both of those parts working together to make the system function well. Actually, Adam Smith himself says that. When I go through Adam Smith in the book, I point out that by the time you reach the end of the book, the invisible hand is highly qualified. There are many exceptions that he introduces to it. So that by the end, you get a reasonably balanced understanding of the relation between the state and the market. But the slogan, the invisible hand slogan, is what tends to stick in people's minds.
So what's your suggestion then about how it's being interpreted today or where the world ought to go next? Are you saying out with self-interest or we should always be consulting a moral guidebook alongside the economic playbook? What are you suggesting?
I certainly think that we ought to recognize that economic decisions, even when they're taken in the context of reasonably competitive markets, have moral consequences, and we ought to think about those decisions and find ways to talk about them. I have a more modest goal, really, with this book. I don't have a grand plan or a scheme for the right way to run society. What I would like to do is give more people the confidence to form their own judgments and judgments partly from a moral ground about economic policies and economic interactions. And that's really why I wrote the book.
That sounds like a modest goal, a mild goal. But you also point out that when students are brought into the world of economics, one of the first things they're told is to think like an economist, which, as you describe it, typically suggests dropping that moral prism.
Well, that's it. And that's why the book is largely about political economy and economics and tries to redress what I have felt in my lifetime is a veering of economics in a unfortunate direction based on this idea that, first of all, the economic sphere is separate from the rest of human life. So we teach economics without its roots in history, philosophy, and sociology. Second, that it's got a morally different character. So we teach a rather strange notion of a division between positive and normative elements in economics, which I don't think really holds water. In the end, wind up trying to persuade people that there are economic laws, something like physical laws, that are governing our economic interactions, which leaves them feeling kind of helpless and in this TINA, there is no alternative kind of mode.
When your fellow economists read your work on this, of course, this has been your song for a long time, Duncan Foley, but do they look at you as soft-hearted, soft-headed? I'm reading Robert Solow, a friend of yours, as he describes it, Nobel Prize winner in economics, but he says, look, when the oncologist says that you need painful chemotherapy, you don't sit around and second-guess them on the nature of their thought process. He's kind of suggesting economists are indeed scientists of a type, too, and if there's pain that comes along with it, well, that's the world.
Economists have some good insights, and they should certainly be allowed to put forward their point of view about these matters. I don't think they should be allowed to bully people. I had the very great privilege of working with Bob Solow at MIT for several years at the beginning of my career and admire him and his work immensely. No, economics is not exactly like oncology. I might even dispute that a little bit with doctors. I think people should get on their hind legs and discuss the whole life consequences of treatments, too.
And so there we sit with Adam Smith and the lessons we've drawn from it and them described as cool and clear and scientific, and Duncan Foley, you saying, not that simple. We've got to keep our moral judgment at work. Duncan Foley has begun to unfold his thesis here, and I want to begin to get some feedback to it from Alan Meltzer. George W. Bush honored him as one of the leading economists of his time, foremost authority on the U.S. Federal Reserve System. He was friends with free market proponent and champion Milton Friedman, libertarian, free market monetarist. He's professor of political economy and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. He joins us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Alan Meltzer, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So you know Duncan Foley has taught and studied this for a long time. He looks at what's going on with economics and says, wait a minute, this is more theology than science, and to think otherwise is a fallacy, and it's important for us to recognize that. How do you respond?
Well, first, Adam Smith also wrote a book about morals and about the rules of society and the importance of having those rules. So the point that Duncan Foley is made is not lost on Adam Smith. It wasn't lost on Milton Friedman. We need certain kinds of rules in society. No one believes that we can have anarchy. We always have to have some kind of government. And to say that this is a discovery seems to me to be far from the truth. It strikes me that what we debate politically in democratic capitalist societies is always the question of where you draw the line between the things that the government does and the things that the public does. We don't always draw it in the right place, but that certainly is a major issue in almost all issues. Think about Medicare. The Republicans want private accounts. The Democrats don't. I mean, that's this issue. Social Security. The Republicans want private accounts. The Democrats don't. Medicare, Social Security, hundreds of regulatory issues, the issues about Sarbanes-Oxley, are the heavy hand of the state versus the private wishes of the marketplace. So those are issues that we discuss all the time. That's a central issue in our society and in every democratic society. As far as the market is concerned, the market is extremely potent, as I think Duncan Foley recognizes. Mm-hmm. We can just take some examples. Take China, which stagnated for hundreds of years, turned to a market economy, encouraged capital formation and private ownership, mainly by foreigners. And what happened? The growth rate went up to 10% a year.
And we've all watched that. Alan Meltzer, let me put this to Duncan Foley. Professor Foley, Alan Meltzer says, look, as you pointed out yourself, but he says, Adam Smith cared about morals. Milton Friedman cared about morals. He describes it as kind of a matter of degree. We debate exactly how we apply some moral screen to economics. You're describing it as more essential perception or misperception, as I read you. How do you respond?
Well, first, I'd like to say hello to Alan Meltzer, whose work I've known and admired for a long time since I was a graduate student quite a while ago. We share an interest in money and central banking issues. Mm. The theme of the book, Adam's Fallacy, is that when you look at the work of the great economists, I decided not to deal with the work of anyone who was living at the time that I was writing the book. Mm-hmm. So I stop with Hayek in the more conservative vein.
whom you'll agree, I think, wrote mostly about law, legislation, liberty, and where the dividing line should be. I mean, he may not have wanted it in the same place that you would, but he certainly recognized that that was a major problem that every society had to solve.
The premise of the book is that every one of these great economists, I deal with Smith, Malthus, Ricardo, Marx, the neoclassical economists, Keynes, Hayek, Veblen, and Schumpeter, are actually deeply involved in this discussion that I call Adam's fallacy, the question of what is the relation between the market and economic life and the rest of life, and what's the value or moral issues. What someone like Milton Friedman believed personally and what gets taught to economic sophomores can sometimes, there's sometimes quite a bit of slippage there, and what gets taught to economic sophomores is much more likely to be his distinction between positive and normative economics than the notion that in the positive economics there is a strong adoption of a certain point of view about life and what it's about and what our goals are.
But you're describing something essential here. When you say Adam's fallacy, you are going all the way back to Adam Smith and saying he got something fundamentally wrong, whereas Alan Meltzer is saying it's a matter of degree and interpretation.
And Adam Smith wrote a book about morals. I mean, a very important book about morals. So he was certainly aware of the fact that society's rules depended upon this. But let me take up the point that Duncan is making now.
Mm.
That is that when we teach economics, we teach it as a scientific discipline subject to certain rules, as any scientific discipline must be. I don't object when I go to the doctor that my doctor was trained, let's say, as an oncologist, and what he knows is oncology. He doesn't know about some of the side effects of the drugs that he gives me, although he should. He doesn't know about a lot of the other things that might happen to me. He knows about oncology. If I go to the nephrologist who works on kidneys, or he knows about kidneys. He doesn't know about all these other things, and we don't train them to do that. The same is true of economics. That just means that to make a whole person, we don't have to do it all in the economics classroom. And presumably the student is going to take political science, sociology, physics, other things that he's going to learn that economics is embedded in a social nexus where rules and morals and political pressures operate.
So we've got a lot on the table. Duncan Foley says get the moral element in there vigorously. See that it has to be there from the get-go. I want to bring our listeners in as well, if I may, from Spokane, Washington. Dan's calling. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom and Dr. Foley. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Tom, I'd like to read about a one-sentence quote from Ben Stein. I'm sure both of you read Ben Stein's eulogy of Milton Friedman.
Yeah, writes in the New York Times, appears all over the place. What do you have there, Dan?
Well, he says Friedman, who idolized Adam Smith, quote, proved, inasmuch as can be proved, that free markets would not impoverish the poor, but would enrich them, and would not ride roughshod over the downtrodden, but would empower them. I'd like to make an observation, and then I'd like to ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
My observation is that I think Friedman's style of economics, which is to say Adam Smith's, basically, might work a bit better in an infinite universe. That is to say, maybe a better stated, an infinite world available to all of us. And since we don't live in an infinite world, and in fact, since we are hitting, it seems to me, increasingly we're hitting the boundaries. We're hitting the wall of...
You're talking resources.
Of resources. We're hitting the wall of resources on our planet here.
Mm-hmm.
And since there is a finitude to it, that I think in an infinite world, Adam Smith's and Friedman's ideas would work to some extent.
But it's not exactly infinite, so where's your question go, Dan?
So what... My sense is that Friedman's... economics were appropriate for, you know, the 50s and 60s, but in the world we're living in now, he's a dinosaur, and I'd like to know what Dr. Foley thinks of how things work in Sweden and Chile, which was Friedman's pet back 20 or 30 years ago.
Dan, thank you for your call from Spokane. Let us pick it up. Duncan Foley, what about it? Does it matter in your mind whether we're in a resource-abundant or infinite resource world or a resource-limited world when it comes to the terms you're describing working with here?
In the book, I make the point that among the early political economists, there was a big division on this question. Malthus and Ricardo, in particular, were theorists of limits to growth, as we would call it mm-hmm. today, basically resource limits to growth. Whereas Smith, and curiously enough, Karl Marx, in this respect, I think was basically a Smithian economist, had much more faith in the power of capitalist innovation to overcome resource limitations or to mitigate them. That's an interesting debate, but it goes very, very far back. I believe that Milton Friedman thought exactly what was quoted in Ben Stein's obituary there, that the free market was the best path to try to alleviate poverty. But I think that is what I would call a theological, not a scientific opinion.
I want to get the voice of Milton Friedman in this conversation, if I may, Duncan Foley, Alan Meltzer. Alan Meltzer, you talked about Adam Smith and Milton Friedman both saying, yes, there's a role here for government, but it could be an awfully light one. Let me just play a little tape here. Here's the Nobel Prize winning economist, free market champ Milton Friedman. He was with us on the show in January last year, and he laid out his big free market vision. I asked him about the free market's role in creating the Enron scandal. Milton Friedman turned the question back on me.
Let me ask you, how did the world find out about Enron?
Well, their deal started to unfold after the California energy crisis.
No, but anyway, but tell me, was it the government that discovered that Enron was corrupt?
No.
It was a market.
Yes.
It was a collapse of the price of the stock price. The market doesn't like corruption. The market likes a situation in which people can be trusted, and it therefore punishes corruption very, very heavily.
But that collapse of Enron meant a terrible blow for the retirement of thousands of Enron employees and major losses for others. Are you saying that in order to have the full benefits of capitalism, we just have to get used to a kind of very cruel moments, that there's no mediating those?
No, I think something different, mm-hmm. that there is no system that you can imagine, no magic system which will avoid having bad things as well as good things. There's no perfect world, and I'm saying that that government is not effective in uncovering and eliminating things like Enron. It's not nearly as effective as a private market is. But that's not to say that everything's going to be ideal. Utopia is not for the not for the real world.
And there, Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman, who's just passed in the last couple of weeks, you're talking with us in January 2005. Alan Meltzer, there's Milton Friedman saying, even Enron, just kind of a speed bump here. The markets eventually took care of it, but for the country and its employees, that did not look like too good a deal.
Well, but think about corruption in government, not just in the United States, but all over the world. I mean, there's no, as Milton said very well, capitalism works well because it's a system which is designed for people as they are, not for people as some of us would like to see them. It works on us, imperfect human beings. As Immanuel Kant said, you know, there is no tree so straight, so crooked, that it could not be made into man.
So no utopia, no perfection, crooked all over the place, Duncan Foley.
That's right.
Well, I would say this is a very, very moving language, and I am very deeply held language. But to my mind, it's theological language. It's about the nature of man, the nature of reality, and what we can hope for arranging our affairs. Those are theological questions. When you see people like Milton Friedman and Alan Meltzer saying those things, then I question why you walk into a classroom and you don't make that part of the lecture, and if there really is any way we can depend on the sociologists or the physicists to put all this in a context.
Yes. Let me go back to the question, to the issue that we had before,
mm-hmm.
when we talk about growth and poverty and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We had 40 years in India of socialist planning, and we had a 2% growth rate on average. We opened the economy. It began to grow. We had 8% growth for many years. Mm. We really reduced more poverty in China and India in the last 5 years than under all World Bank programs, all redistribution programs, all Swedish and Norwegian programs for 50 years. I mean, doesn't that tell you something? Now, there are people...
Incidentally, I'd like to agree with that. I think you're on the... I think that's correct.
Now, there are people who will say, and I think Duncan will agree with this, that there are some who are left behind. There are some who are left behind in our country because they're incompetent, because they don't have the willingness to get up every day and go to work because they're on drugs and so on. Of course there are going to be social problems in every society, but that isn't to say that the market is doing its job. It isn't doing the whole job.
Duncan Foley,
I agree with Duncan that we embed the market system in a social nexus in which the ideas and beliefs of people in the society become very important as to how that market system works.
But, Professor Foley, I read you saying something more than that. You describe something emerging from the markets, what you call a commodity logic, penetrating more and more areas of human life. And I read you describing it as corrosive to values, tradition, social cohesion. If I'm reading you right, this is what you call not just Adam's fallacy, but Adam's curse.
Yes, the end of the book, I do talk a lot about the commodity boundary and how much of human life we want to bring into market logic and the logic of the commodity. Milton Friedman was extremely ingenious in his proposals to extend commodity logic and market principles to wider and wider spheres of human life. In one particular case, I was a strong supporter of his idea, namely the negative income tax, which is now turned into the earned income tax credit. And, you know, in general, I don't want to take a blanket position. Is it always bad to commoditize? Is it always bad to use market principles? No.
But you seem pretty clear that it's bad if it becomes universal, if everything is swallowed up by the market's commoditizing effect as you have it.
Well, I think we have to question it and question it in each case and question it very closely in each case so that we understand exactly what we're doing.
Alan Meltzer, reduced or elevated by the market's effects?
Oh, I think we are clearly elevated. Think about some of the Milton Friedman proposals. You talked about the negative income tax. We have it in the form of the earned income tax credit. Mm-hmm. Talk about welfare reform in the Clinton administration. I mean, we move people from a dismal life on welfare into the workforce, where they learn to work, do a job every day, teach their children that that's what adults do. Adults don't sit around at home and watch TV. They go to work. They earn a living. They get educated.
Paul's calling from Roland, North Carolina. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Adam. I just wanted to make a practical comment for myself. I've just been in the United States about 16 years, and I came from a communist regime from Albania.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we came in the U.S., and I'm a U.S. citizen, by the way, right now, but as soon as we came here, we saw and understood the meaning of freedom, which is that Constitution. And we worked very hard, extremely hard, and we came in the United States with only $13 and reached sovereign new heights that a lot of people cannot even dream. And to me, that's all it is, the meaning of law and order and the meaning of freedom. Without knowing much on the economics, I do appreciate all the comments that Dr. Adam is doing, but I think there are quite a few flaws on that one. I'm not much on economics, but I...
Paul, we hear where you're standing. You're speaking from your personal experience. It feels good, and it's worked for you, Dr. Foley, Duncan Foley. There's a kind of simple attestation. Paul says, I was in that system. I came to this one. I like this one better. It looks like it's working to him.
Well, I'd like to congratulate you on your success and good fortune. The U.S. has been a place where many people have had that story happen to them. It is not only because we have a vigorous market economy. It's also because the market economy from the time of Alexander Hamilton on has operated in a very complex and on the whole fruitful partnership with government that has happened.
Are you saying that you're dissatisfied with the status quo then, Duncan Foley, or are you looking forward and saying you're worried about where the markets take us if we're not more avidly moral in our understanding and exercise of them?
I think my main I'm less happy with the way economics is taught and the what I see as a kind of dogmatic tendency creeping into the teaching of economics than I am with the political debate in the United States. I think the political debate is vigorous, and as Alan Meltzer pointed out, it's about the right things, the boundaries of commoditization, the boundaries between the market and the state. I'd like to see economics profession incorporate that more fundamentally in the
way. Why does that matter?
We talk and
Alan Meltzer says you can learn that elsewhere. Learn it, you know, at Temple or in a political science class or at church. You write about this as a dubious division, the division of the economic sphere from the messy kind of moral realm. He's suggesting, as I hear him, that it's not so dubious. It's all right.
But look, you look at somebody like Milton Friedman in the lovely little excerpt you just played us. There's no doubt that Milton Friedman is a person of tremendous moral fervor, and that lies behind the way he thinks about the society, the individual, the relation of the society to the individual, and that's what comes through. On the other hand, there seems to be something schizophrenic then in Friedman saying, well, we're going to divide economics up between the positive, which is the laws of the commodity and the laws of the market, which have no values in them, and the normative, which is what you get from Temple or church. It doesn't make sense to me. There's values in what Milton Friedman is talking about.
Alan Meltzer, do you have any fear that over an extended period, that kind of what Duncan Foley calls a dubious division leaves us with a more values-free world, a kind of corrosive to social cohesion? I mean, do the markets come with enough on the moral front to maintain the right human whole balance over time?
Well, I have a very strong view about that. I think the last thing I would like to see is to have economics professors teaching morals as part of economics, explaining what they would like. I mean, their view of society is no better than other people's view of society. Their moral judgments are the moral judgments that they choose to make, but they may not be the same moral judgments that the students have learned to take. So I think it's right that they teach economic science, that is the positive part of economics, and leave to the morals to what you learn at your mother's and father's knees.
Let me go to Eileen in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Hi, Eileen. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi.
I'm an economist. I teach at a small private college.
Yeah.
And so my question is this. Free market ideology teaches us that discrimination will be competed away or eliminated. And from what Professor Meltzer is saying, it sounds like he's saying that most African Americans are just too lazy to get up and work.
Not at all.
But first, Eileen, how are you making the leap to that? What's the logic chain you've got?
Well, he seemed to say that for people who are not doing well, that they're simply lazy.
So you're saying the market is failing here, that they're not lazy and it's still not working for them.
That's correct.
I would answer that very simply by saying the reason we have made progress in eliminating racial discrimination certainly has much more to do with the market. What the government did that was very important was to remove the restrictions that the government itself was enforcing. The fact that the schools were not were segregated, that was a Supreme Court decision enforced by the government. The fact that the drinking fountains were segregated, that was enforced as a matter of law. The fact that buses were segregated. I worked on the first bus case in North Carolina where we desegregated the interstate buses. So I'm very familiar with those stories. Those were federally or state-enforced prohibitions. We eliminated those, and when we eliminated them through the Voting Rights Act, through the Public Accommodations Act, those things removed restrictions which government placed on the rights of individuals.
Economist Eileen, what do you say?
How would you explain the continued, relatively low-income, high unemployment rates among African Americans?
It takes a long time, as we see in most countries, to get people into the workforce, to get them educated. I mean, blacks certainly have been the victims of terrible discrimination by the state. But what we've done now is taken a big forward step. We freed them to be able to do that by eliminating the or changing the welfare laws. We've encouraged their parents to go into the labor force. People learn by observing what's around them. Mm. If parents don't work, they don't think that work is a part of what people do.
Duncan Foley, what do you say about Eileen's complaint on the discrimination front within the market system?
It doesn't eliminate discrimination automatically from competition, and there has to be a partnership of government and other social entities, churches and value-laden, value-producing institutions to get anywhere with a problem like that. I think it's a very intractable, difficult problem.
And Alan Meltzer
says...
I'd
like to ask Alan Meltzer a question, though, about if you have a minute for me to do that.
Yes, please.
Alan, go back to the Milton Friedman excerpt that we just heard. I mean, do you get from listening to Milton there that he is a person who really sees a scientific aspect of the market as just a way of allocating resources, which we can pragmatically use or not use as we choose, depending on the specific case? Or is he a person who really thinks the market is a positive moral good?
He was wise enough to recognize that that the argument from economics was a scientific argument about the superiority of the market in producing the outcomes that people most preferred. He was also smart enough to know that that wouldn't satisfy everyone, that this is an imperfect world. Look, just look around. We ask about discrimination against blacks. Look elsewhere in the world. In every place that you look, you see that there are antipathies and hatreds that go back hundreds of years. Discrimination, that's something that we want to overcome. But the market is a system that will overcome it if we free the market to do those things, to hire the most efficient, best workers to do the job. And that's the case for the market. That isn't going to solve all our problems. There will always be some. It's not a perfect world. As Milton Friedman said, you know, we can design worlds for utopia, but no one lives in those worlds. We live in a world with imperfect human beings, and the rules of the market are ways which helps them to do better.
Let me take another call, if I may, from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mitchell's on the line. Mitchell, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. It's you and your guest, Tom. The conversation is very interesting, but what's being left out is the fact that the idea of free enterprise that people are talking about so easily doesn't exist, because essentially we're living in monopoly markets. And I would go back to Adam Smith and his contemporaries, the physiocrats in France, who basically said that the idea of laissez-faire was hinged upon a legitimate role of government, which was to make sure there was an equal playing field for the free market to operate. And until you remove the obstacles to equality, you could not have free markets. And we are in that situation now. The major policy recommendation that the physiocrats made, certainly, and I think you could draw it through to the ideas of David Ricardo in his theory of economic rent, which is so overlooked, is that by taxing away the speculative values of land and natural resources and untaxing human labor and economic productivity, you would go a long way towards creating the equality in the playing field that we should be talking about but are not.
But you're saying on that side we don't live in utopia either. Let us pick that up. Duncan Foley, what about it? Is it possible that the theory is perfect but the markets are not, and therefore the skepticism is warranted?
To my mind, that kind of argument has all the hallmarks of a theological argument. The market has as much a role in creating these problems as it does in solving them, or at least I would not necessarily say as much, but it certainly has a role in creating these problems as well as in solving them. You won't, incidentally, find Ricardo and his theory of rent neglected in my book. There's quite a bit on that in there. And I think one of the reasons I wrote the book was because I think modern economics teaching is neglecting a lot of the treasures of the past of the history of economic thought.
But Alan Meltzer says, please, please do not bring moral teaching into the economics classroom. That's not the role for the economics teacher.
Well, there won't be one, Tom.
there'll be, you know, every shade of opinion you can imagine.
Yeah, I understand that. But Duncan Foley, what do you say?
I think it's not going to hurt for people to be more upfront about their values and their beliefs about the way that the individual and society can interact. Alan Meltzer is very eloquent about that in his view of the imperfection of life and the fact that the market is, on the whole, the best way to cope with that. I have nothing against that opinion, and I think undergraduates can certainly hear it and think about it and criticize it for themselves. But it seems to me that is the content of economic teaching.
And you write that you wrote the book to give people more confidence in their own moral judgments as they look out on the economic sphere. Let me take a call from Amherst, Massachusetts. Terry's on the line. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Mr. Meltzer is talking about, you know, let's leave morals to the ethics classes and whatever. But at least you can show the students, these companies, how they make their, who's working for these companies, where these companies are, and at least give them that information. And seriously, I think that your guest is trying to put a face on this New York stock market or on the market in general. And I see the difference between the two guests, that one has a conscience and one has a conscience that's fast asleep, and I don't know what he's taking to do that. But I do think that people have to know where these jobs are and who's making these products. And for the person who called in and said, you know, you're implying that we're all lazy and we don't want to work, well, you're the people who are investing in the market are more than happy to see wages low and product high, and that means sending all the work overseas. Where are the jobs in the U.S.?
Terry, thanks for your call. Alan Meltzer, what about the time frame here, the horizon? Maybe all things are made well by the market in time, but if human life is a lot shorter than that time and we see inequities in the interim, does that require intervention?
First of all, I didn't say that all the people who were unemployed were malingering. I said that we could use the market system to solve some of these problems, but there would be people, drug addicts, people who are incompetent, would be left behind.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to say what people have interpreted.
All right.
Let me say also that this argument that we are losing jobs and so on, we have unemployments are at historically low levels. We have most people who want to work are working. So it isn't true that we are exporting jobs. We are exporting jobs. We are importing jobs. I mean, people don't believe that Toyota has hundreds of thousands of people working in the United States. Honda has people working in the United States. There are many, many foreign companies here employing Americans, creating jobs. So it just isn't true, this myth that is circulated, that we are losing jobs. We are not losing jobs. We are gaining jobs all the time. We are gaining a different mix of jobs. And that may be long-run good, or it may not be long-run good, but we don't know. We won't know that until we get there. My view is the market system solves many problems and solves them very well. We have to have rules in society for areas where the public doesn't like the market solution, or where, for some reason, the market doesn't work.
And our time grows short with that. Duncan Foley, the last word goes to you. What are you hoping that readers, that the country takes away from the message you're putting out here when it looks at the economy and our lives?
I would wish three things. I wish some people will read the book. I think if they do, they'll see that the story of the book is a complex story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story about the intertwining of theological themes and scientific themes in economics.
Mm.
I would like to see economists, if we're going to pursue this medical analogy, much more concerned about what you might call the moral side effects of economic policy and economic decisions, and to try to prepare students to understand those moral side effects and to cope with them. And finally, I'd like to return to the point that you read from the book. The book is really intended to try to help people understand economics, understand where it came from, understand how values and science are intertwined in it, and to make them more confident about their own judgments about it.
Their moral judgments don't have to submit to a tyranny of markets, I guess you say, in a way. Duncan Foley, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. We thank you for your work on the book, your lifetime of teaching it. Adam's Fallacy, A Guide to Economic Theology is the new book. Professor Foley, thank you for your time today.
And thank you, Tom.
I congratulate him on writing this book. I think it's good to raise these questions and have them debated publicly.
Alan Meltzer,
I'd love to hear your comments on it if you get a chance to read it.
I'm sure you will. Alan Meltzer in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon University, thank you for your time as well. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.